From NPR, this is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. We begin today with a tale of a man known as a miser. A man so unmoved by the plight of others that he has become synonymous with greed and selfishness. His name was Ebenezer Scrooge.
Mr. Scrooge, I presume.
Indeed you do, sir.
Scrooge, of course, was a character in Charles Dickens's famous story, A Christmas Carol. And yes, I know it's not Christmas, but stay with me a moment.
Humbug.
In this 1984 film version of the story, Scrooge refuses to give money to a charity that's helping the poor.
My taxes help to support the public institutions which I have mentioned, and they cost enough. Those who are badly off must go there.
Many can't go there, and many would rather die.
If they would rather die, perhaps they had better do so and decrease the surplus population.
Surely you don't mean that.
Scrooge is visited one night by some unwelcome guests who push him to question his outlook. They're ghosts. The first two remind him about his past and present and ask him to embrace the Christmas spirit. It's to no avail. Scrooge cares more about his money than his community. But then he's visited by a third ghost who shows him his future. A grave. Terrified at the prospect of his own death, Scrooge begs the ghost to allow him to make amends.
Hear me, I am not the man I was. I will not be the man I must have been but for this visitation.
He promises to become kind and generous, to care about his community, to embrace the Christmas spirit. Moments later, he wakes up.
I'm alive. Oh, thank you, spirit. I will keep my promise.
Here's why we're revisiting the story of Ebenezer Scrooge. We tend to think of A Christmas Carol as a parable about the dangers of shutting our hearts to other people. But there's another lesson that comes from the story. It's a lesson about death. It was the fear of death that caused Scrooge to change his ways. And there is a great psychological truth in that story. Many of us shy away from consciously thinking about death, but it turns out death still figures in our minds far more often than most of us realize, and these thoughts produce an extraordinary range of human responses, from the kind and generous to the strange and absurd. Mortality and the path to eternal life. This week on Hidden Brain. When Sheldon Solomon was 8 years old, his mother told him about death.
This was the day before my grandmother died of cancer. And I remember my mom saying to me, oh, say goodbye to grandma because she's very ill. And I knew that, but then she died the next day. And I just remember because I was looking at postage stamps that I collected at the time of dead presidents. And I was like, wow, Washington's dead, Jefferson's dead, grandma's dead. That would all be fine, except for me being on deck in the long run.
Sheldon realized that one day, his time would also come. Decades later, that story reemerged in his life. He was a young professor at Skidmore College. He was searching for a book in the library when something in the Freud section caught his eye.
It was a book by a recently deceased cultural anthropologist, Ernest Becker. And that one was called The Birth and Death of Meaning. And in the first paragraph, Becker says, I want to understand what makes people act the way they do. And I said, oh, me too. Finally, somebody not writing in turgid jargon that's a non-pharmacological intervention for insomnia. Just asking a straightforward question. You know, what makes people act the way that they do?
Sheldon saw more books on the shelf by the same author.
So I grabbed the next book, The Denial of Death, and again, the first paragraph, Becker writes, the idea of death, the fear of it, haunts the human animal like nothing else. It is a mainspring of human activity. And in my gut, that brought me way back to being 8 years old. I knew that that statement was at the very least true for my own life, and I suspected that it was true for most folks as well.
Sheldon reached out to two friends, Tom Pyszynski and Jeff Greenberg. Like him, they were young psychologists. All three of them fell in love with Ernest Becker's books. The central idea that captivated them was that people construct mental defenses to ward off the fear of death. The three psychologists wrote up a paper elaborating on this concept. They would eventually call this idea terror management theory. They sent off their paper to a top journal, certain they were going to rock the world of psychology.
We didn't hear anything for about 6 months. And then we got a review, and the paper was rejected with a one-sentence review. The reviewer said something along the lines of, "I have no doubt that these ideas are of no interest whatsoever to any psychologist alive or dead."
Sometime later, the researchers ran into the president of the American Psychological Association at a conference, and they asked him why the paper had been rejected.
And we just said, "Hey, we think these are good ideas," to which he replied, "They might be, but psychology is an empirical discipline. You guys are experimental psychologists, and so why not try to gather evidence in support of Becker's claims?" And it was in response to that suggestion that we generated what we call terror management theory, which is basically just our effort to take all of Becker's ideas and to generate hypotheses that we could subject to empirical scrutiny.
Sheldon and his co-authors started running experiments.
So the first study was done on municipal court judges in Tucson, Arizona, and we randomly divided them into two groups. Half of the judges were reminded of their mortality by, in the middle of a bunch of questionnaires, being asked to just write down their thoughts and feelings about their own mortality. And then we showed them an actual court case of an alleged prostitute, which was the most common crime in Tucson's municipal court at the time. And we just asked them, "Well, how much bail would you set? That's the amount of money that you have to pay to not be imprisoned until your trial." So what we found is in the control condition, the judges set an average bail of $50. And that was good because that was the average bail for that crime at the time. However, the judges reminded that they were going to die, they set a 9 times higher bail, an average of $455. And what was astonishing is not only the magnitude of that difference, but also the vociferousness of the judges' resistance when we told them at the end of the study what we had done. They just said, "There's no way that your idiot death questionnaire could have in any way altered the way that I adjudicated this particular case." So I guess the take-home message is if you're going to court for a traffic ticket, you better hope that the judge hasn't driven past the cemetery on the way to court that day.
It might be difficult to see how this is connected to Ernest Becker's ideas, so let's slow down a minute. The central idea of terror management theory is that we cope with the fear of death by constructing mental defenses. Those defenses, Sheldon and his co-authors found, tend to fall into a couple of patterns. The first main line of defense when we are prompted to think about death is to retreat into cultural safe havens. Our religions, our communities, our values. The idea here is that by immersing ourselves in the language and norms of our cultural groups, we become part of something that is less mortal, the groups that will outlive us. When the judges were reminded of their mortality, they became, in a way, more conservative in their morality. They sought to punish women who had broken the norms of their culture. Of course, there could be other explanations for this behavior. So Sheldon and his co-authors decided to conduct a new experiment. They reasoned that if they were right, the same forces driving judges to treat sex workers harshly would also produce another effect. When people are reminded of death, they should also want to reward those who exemplify the norms of the community.
If somebody does something that's in accord with your belief system, then being reminded of death should make you like them more. So in a subsequent study, we had participants either think about themselves dying or something unpleasant, and then we showed them a newspaper article about a citizen who thwarted a bank robbery, and we just asked them, well, how much monetary reward should the citizen receive? In the control condition, it was about $1,000, and in the death condition, it was over $3,000.
So I want to talk about a couple of other studies as well, just to lay out the terrain here. And what's interesting is that these studies have been conducted in many different countries. You once asked Germans about their preferences in food, cars, and vacations, and some were interviewed in a retail setting, and others were interviewed in front of a cemetery. What did you find?
Yes, this is a great study for a few reasons. We didn't do it, and that makes it better because when other researchers can replicate your findings, that's always important for scientific purposes. It also used a very clever manipulation. One way that we remind people that they're going to die is to just ask them how they feel about it. A more subtle way is to stop people either in front of a funeral parlor or 100 meters to either side. And our thought was that if you're in front of a funeral parlor, particularly in Germany, where they often have embalmed corpses in the window, well, death should be on your mind, even if it's hidden from your own awareness. And sure enough, Germans, reminded of their mortality, become more supportive of buying German goods. They also sit closer to fellow Germans and further away from other folks who look like Turkish immigrants.
So one of the things that I think would surprise people is not the thesis that death is terrifying, but the idea that the terror of death has such widespread ramifications and effects in our lives. And I'm wondering if you can just address this. In some ways, it is a form of criticism of your theory. It's one thing to say, yes, you know, we have concerns about death, but how do you go from there to saying that this actually has a profound role in almost everything that we think, say, and do?
Yeah, people dismissed Becker for being broad to the point of grandiose when he said that anxiety about death is essentially the central driver of what it is that motivates us as human beings. When you talk to people about Becker's ideas, they'll be like, this is crazy. I don't think about death all the time. And Becker's view is that you don't think about death all the time because you're comfortably embedded in your cultural worldview in a way that buffers you from death anxiety by virtue of the fact that you feel like you're a person of value in a world of meaning.
The idea here is that even though the anxiety about death is ever present, we are largely oblivious to it because our mental defenses are strong. We soothe ourselves with our anthems and our rituals and our conviction that our religion is the best. One way these defenses are breached is when we come into contact with people different than us, people who have their own beliefs. Now, we must either accept that beliefs are just that, beliefs, or we must try to establish that our beliefs are better.
If I accept, let's say, the Fulani and Mali, who say the earth was created out of a giant drop of milk, well, that undermines the veracity of the Judeo-Christian account where God created heaven and earth in 6 days. What Becker said, therefore, is that when we encounter people who are different, we tend to belittle them. We tend to try to convince or coerce them to dispose of their ideas, or we just kill them, thus proving that our God and our ideas are better after all.
Sheldon Solomon and other terror management theorists also find that people have a second kind of response to the fear of death. They find ways to boost their own self-esteem. Besides saying, my culture is superior, my nation is the best, my religion is the most profound, they also say, I'm the best, I'm better looking than other people, I'm smarter, I'm richer.
We call it self-esteem striving. And so, for example, I think the first study was by Orit Taubman Ben-Ari in Israel, and the participants were Israeli soldiers. And they measured the extent to which the soldier's self-esteem was based on their driving prowess. I don't know if you've been to Israel, but they are very maniacal. I say this with love and respect. And then they put them on a driving simulator. And they measured how fast and how recklessly the soldiers drove. And again, the good news is in the control condition, the soldiers drove quite modestly. But when they were reminded of their mortality first, the soldiers whose self-esteem was based on their driving skills, they drove faster and more recklessly. Other studies have shown that skin divers reminded of their mortality, they say they would stay underwater in more dangerous weather or when they were running out of oxygen. People who value their basketball skill, when they're reminded of their mortality, they actually shoot better at the foul line. People that think they're strong, if you give them something to squeeze, when you remind them of their mortality, they actually squeeze harder. So these are just different demonstrations that we shore up our self-esteem in response to existential anxieties.
I'm wondering if one of the insights in these studies is that what we're really trying to avoid is actually not death, but the fear of death. And it's interesting and instructive that you've named your theory terror management theory as opposed to death management theory. It's not about avoiding death. It's about avoiding the fear of death.
Yes, I think you're quite right. And there is good evidence to suggest that for some, it's really not the prospect of being dead. The real horror is to be privy to the moments when we're in the process of that transition itself.
What does terror management theory predict about the kind of leaders that we are drawn to, Sheldon?
Yes, terror management theory predicts that when existential anxieties are aroused, that we are more likely to embrace what the sociologist Max Weber called a charismatic leader.
Thank you all.
So, in the aftermath of September 11th, we argued, based on our studies, that it was our own existential anxieties that attracted Americans to President Bush.
This nation stands with the good people of New York City and New Jersey and Connecticut as we mourn the loss of thousands of our citizens.
And then, if we fast forward to 2015, 2016, and Donald Trump declared his candidacy for the presidency, saying, look, illegal swarms are coming over the southern border.
They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us.
Terrorists are going to come into the United States and they're going to kill us. And he said, look, I am the only one who can keep you safe. I'm going to make America great again. So we did studies in 2015 and 16. American respondents reminded of death were more supportive of now President Trump and said they were more likely to vote for him when they were reminded of their mortality. When it became evident that Donald Trump was running against Hillary Clinton, we found the respondents preferred Clinton to Trump in a psychologically benign state of mind. But if they were reminded of their mortality first, their enthusiasm and support for President Trump was substantially increased. And then, moreover, we did other studies where we showed that just asking an American to think about a mosque being built in their neighborhood or an immigrant moving into their town, that was sufficient to make unconscious death thoughts come more readily to mind. And that, in turn, increased support for now President Trump. And this is important because President Trump doesn't have death reminders in his rallies. And so one might wonder, well, how is this of practical significance? Well, the fact is that he doesn't have to. Just keeping immigration and terrorism and the idea that the Chinese and every other country, for the most part, are a mortal threat to us by virtue of their aggressive trade practices, all of that, whether the president is aware of it or not, serves to maintain a high level of death anxiety, and that in turn serves to maintain greater support for a charismatic leader.
You've done some work looking at how liberals and conservatives behave toward one another in an experiment that involves hot sauce. Tell me about that study.
So we had liberal and conservative participants who thought they were working with a liberal or conservative partner, and then they learned that their partner didn't like spicy foods. And they were told, well, okay, you're going to eat some crackers and rate how you like them. And your partner's going to eat some hot sauce. And you get to determine how much hot sauce they're going to have to eat, and they have to eat all of it and then rate how pleasant it was. All right, so in the control condition, it didn't matter whether the person you were working with shared your beliefs or not. You gave them the same amount of hot sauce. On the other hand, if you were reminded of dying first, you gave the same amount of sauce to the partner if they shared your politics, but if they didn't, you gave them twice as much. And we confirmed that this was an aggressive reaction by talking to the participants afterwards. They didn't know that it had anything to do with being reminded of their mortality. But when we said, did you know that you were essentially dosing these folks because they didn't like hot sauce? They're like, you're darn right we are.
Sheldon Solomon is a psychology professor at Skidmore College. Along with Jeff Greenberg and Tom Pyszynski, he's the co-author of The Worm at the Core on the Role of Death in Life. Sheldon, thank you for joining me on Hidden Brain today.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Sheldon Solomon has shown how the fear of death provokes odd reactions in us. These reactions are only part of the story, though. Coming up, the narratives humans have created for millennia to explain how death itself can be cheated.
So it seems a crucial part of the success story for a religion that it promised the defeat of death in some way.
I'm Shankar Vedantam, and you're listening to Hidden Brain. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Constant Contact, with email marketing tools to help small businesses build their brands online through customizable email templates, an email editor, and now a website builder. More at ConstantContact.com. And from LD Entertainment and Roadside Attractions, presenting Judy, starring Renee Zellweger as Judy Garland, as she arrives in London for a run of sold-out shows, 30 years after she starred in The Wizard of Oz, now playing in theaters.
From NPR, this is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. The first emperor of China was used to getting his way. By the time he was 40, Qin Shi Huangdi was the most powerful man in the world. During his reign, some 2,000 years ago, he united the warring nations of his kingdom. He standardized currency and weights and measures. He unified border walls into a single block that would eventually become the Great Wall of China. And so it seemed to this man, who had achieved so many things, that he could also conquer something no one had conquered before. Death. He went searching for an elixir that would give him eternal life.
He traveled his kingdom, talking to wizards and alchemists and wise people and priests. And one day, in some distant part of his kingdom, he found a wise man who said, I know the recipe for an elixir.
This is philosopher Stephen Cave. He says the wise man was a wizard named Shui Fu. And Shui Fu's offer to get the elixir came with a few conditions.
You just have to get it from this distant island. And if you give me a ship fully equipped and loaded with virgins, I will be able to go to this island and get the elixir of life for you.
The emperor was ecstatic. He gave Shui Fu the ship, the provisions, and the virgins. And then he carried on ruling over his great empire.
And when he came back to the wizard a few years later, he found out that the virgins were no longer virginal, that the provisions had all gone, and he wondered where this elixir was. And the wizard said, "Ah, well, I tried to find this elixir, but the closer we got to the island, the more sea monsters rose up and defeated us. And so if you can only give us more virgins, more provisions, and a squadron of archers, well, I'll be able to get it for you."
You might be able to guess what happened. The emperor gave him what he wanted, and off Shui Fu went, never to return to China.
But what's a little interesting twist in this story is that around the same time, there is a legend in Japan about a man who came from China with a boatload of provisions and soldiers, so I'm not sure if they mentioned the virgins, and who brought with him a great number of technologies like agriculture and martial arts and building and many other things, and that became the foundation of Japanese civilization.
This story tells us two things. One, humans have been trying to cheat death for thousands of years. And two, the hunger for immortality is inextricably linked to human culture.
Almost everything we think of, these technologies of civilization, like agriculture and martial arts and building and clothing and so forth, are, if you like, life extension technologies. And so I think it's unsurprising that at the heart of the promise, the founding promise of civilization, we find the promise of immortality.
This promise of immortality is a human response to a terrifying idea, the fact that one day we will die. We just spoke with psychologist Sheldon Solomon. He talked about how this fear shapes our actions, often without us being aware of it. Now we pivot from psychology and politics to religion and history as we explore ways people have tried to resolve their fears. Our guide is Stephen Cave. He's the author of Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever, and How It Drives Civilization. Much of the book revolves around a philosophical conundrum that Stephen calls the mortality paradox. We know we will die, but can't really imagine being dead.
It's impossible to imagine not existing. So if you think of trying to imagine being dead, you might imagine being in some other place. You might imagine looking down on your own funeral. But all of these imaginings conjure a kind of observing eye. You're somehow still there as the observer. And that makes it very, very hard to truly believe that we will completely cease to exist. And this, therefore, gives us our paradox. On the one hand, these enormous brains of ours tell us that mortality, that death, is inevitable. But at the same time, when we try to imagine being dead, we find it's impossible, and our brains reject it.
You argue in the book that we find four distinct ways, and have found these four distinct ways throughout human history, to resolve this mortality paradox. You say we come up with these immortality narratives, four techniques that have been used in some ways to sort of bridge the divide of this paradox. I want to talk about them one by one, look at some historical examples of how each of these narratives has been employed, how they're employed in contemporary times, but also some of the potential problems with each of these mortality narratives. Tell me about the first one.
That's right. That, of course, the fear of death and the realization of death is universal. You find it in all human cultures. And in all human cultures, we find these stories and these strivings, these imaginings for how we can overcome death or avoid death. And even though there appears to be an enormous diversity of views, I think they actually fit into four basic broad categories. And the first of them, the most obvious, says, all right, we know life as this body, as this sort of human organism on this world, that easiest and best way to stay alive forever is just not to die in the first place. Now, on the one hand, this might sound very implausible when we look at the extent to which death and disease and aging are part of everyday reality. Yet at the same time, almost every culture in human history has some kind of story of an elixir of life or a fountain of youth or something that can enable us to just keep going in these bodies in this world forever.
So these ideas have been explored at length in popular culture and movies. In the 1992 movie Death Becomes Her, Meryl Streep plays a self-absorbed actress who wants to stay young and beautiful. So she visits a mysterious woman, played by Isabella Rossellini, who offers her a glowing purple liquid.
What is that?
A tonic. A potion.
What does it do?
It stops the aging process dead in its tracks and forces it into retreat. Drink that potion and you'll never grow even one day older. Don't drink it and continue to watch yourself rot.
How much is it?
What I love about this clip, Stephen, is how the story, the search for magic potions, it just comes back over and over again in different forms.
Exactly. We want so desperately to believe this story. And it's so tempting to think that we are the pinnacle of civilization and we are the ones who are enjoying all the fruits of science and technology, and therefore we are the generation who are really going to crack it. We read in the newspapers and we suck up those headlines that say, you know, aging defeated, just eat blueberries and put this cream on your face. And of course, you know, a few decades later, as our skin starts to wrinkle and crumple, we realize it was all just wishful thinking.
So if endless rejuvenation is not a solution, that brings us to the second of your immortality narratives. What is it?
So the second immortality narrative I call resurrection. And it's the second one in our logical sequence because it stays with the idea that we are these physical bodies, these physical organisms. And it says, okay, it looks like death is inevitable. I mean, after all, the one thing that all these elixir seekers in the last few thousand years have in common is that they're all now 6 foot under, pushing up daisies. So if we're not going to find an elixir, we need a plan B. Staying with the idea that we are bodies, we might think, okay, these bodies do have to die, but maybe they can rise and live again. And this is something we see all around us in nature. We see cycles of birth and death, and then rebirth. And a lot of rituals in ancient religions are about taking the very linear progression of a human life from birth through growing and then aging and dying, and transforming it into something more like this cyclical pattern of birth and death and rebirth, reappearing one day like the bluebells do in spring.
So what I like about this is that it has such intuitive appeal. Anyone who has a garden looks out and sees that, you know, plants and shrubs that basically die out in the winter come back in the spring. And it's so easy in some ways to make the intuitive leap that this must be possible for us to do as human beings as well. And the most famous example of this is the resurrection of Jesus. It's the story that's at the heart of Christianity.
That's right. In the milieu in which the Jesus story emerged, obviously 2,000 years ago, there were many legends of heroes or kings who went down to the underworld and after some time there somehow managed to re-emerge, to be reborn. And these cults of rebirth were very closely associated with the seasons and with agriculture and were celebrated in spring and so forth. So it does seem deeply embedded in our psyche, the idea that there's a rhythm of rebirth that we can tap into. And of course, that's what the Jesus story does in a very explicit way. Right? It builds on older Jewish stories of the promise of the resurrection of bones rising from the earth. And we find something like it in nearly all of the world religions. A very explicit promise of immortality can be found in Islam, for example. And we find something similar in Hinduism and Buddhism. So it seems a crucial part of the success story for a religion that it promised the defeat of death in some way.
Like the rejuvenation narrative, the resurrection story has some serious philosophical holes. For one thing, which version of you is the one that gets revived? Is it the young you or the old and frail you?
Now imagine that I die and I'm riddled with cancer and very old and falling apart, and God or scientists resurrect me. They somehow pump life back into me. I climb out of the grave and I immediately fall back into it because I'm old and withered and full of cancer. Well, clearly no one wants to be resurrected as they were just as they died, because they would necessarily just die again. So they have to be transformed in some way. They want to be rejuvenated and made immune to aging and disease, and usually there's a great long wish list of ways in which they'd like to change. And we see this in Christianity. St. Paul talks about being transformed into something immortal and durable, leaving behind all this sort of messy biological stuff. But if I'm to be transformed into something completely different, that isn't messy biology, that isn't, whatever, 80 years old and full of cancer, what is it that makes that new thing me? It sounds like I've been so completely transformed that I have become, if you like, something else. And this is a deep problem with any notion of resurrection.
When we come back, if rejuvenation and resurrection don't work, where do we turn next? I'm Shankar Vedantam, and you're listening to Hidden Brain. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. And from the NPR Wine Club, where every bottle tells a story, and favorite NPR shows become exclusive wines like the Up First Pinot Grigio. Available to adults 21 years or older. NPRWineClub.org.
From NPR, this is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. Stephen Cave is a philosopher at the University of Cambridge. He is the author of Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization. Stephen has identified four immortality narratives that you can find across cultures and across time. The first two are rejuvenation and resurrection. He says those narratives run into philosophical problems, leading us to a third story.
It says, well, maybe I'm not just this physical body that ages and gets diseased and dies and rots. Maybe there's some other kind of part of me that's immaterial and that doesn't rot. And we see in Christianity, for example, the resurrection story is now bolstered by this idea that there is a soul, and the soul continues to exist to kind of keep the real me going while the body is in this abyss of death. And when the resurrection comes, soul and body are reunited, and so the person is whole again. But of course, many people are happy to dispense entirely with the messy, failing, aging, wrinkly body and say, no, the soul is all you need. The soul is the real me. And as long as that continues, then immortality is mine.
Now, you write in the book that 71% of Americans believe they have a soul. Among Brits and Germans, it's closer to 60%. In India, it's over 90%. In Nigeria, it's close to 100%. In other words, most of the world's 7 billion inhabitants believe they possess something that is besides and outside of their body.
Yes, and I think it is a very natural view. After all, we can imagine leaving our bodies behind, and in many traditional religious and mystical practices involve actually cultivating this feeling of entering a kind of dream state or a state in which the spirit is able to travel independently of the body. And at the same time, it goes back to the mortality paradox that we talked about earlier, the idea that we, even though we know death is a fact, at the same time, we can't imagine ceasing to exist. Well, if I say to you, okay, death is a fact, but only for your body, And you can't imagine ceasing to exist because your soul doesn't cease to exist, and that's the real you, then we've solved the mortality paradox very neatly. So it's a kind of, it's a belief that hooks very easily onto our intuitions.
So in some ways, Stephen, Buddhism and Hinduism have solutions to these problems. They say that souls don't hang out in some secret place, but they migrate into a new body. In other words, they are reincarnated. You describe how this happens in the book through the story of one little boy whose name was Lamo Dundup. Tell me that story, please.
So after the 13th Dalai Lama died, it was, of course, very important to the monks of Tibet to find where his soul had gone, where it had been reincarnated. And so they travelled the land for many months, looking for children who would have been born about the same time, bodies that might have been the right receptacles for this soul, if you like. And so after months travelling through snowy mountain passes, they came to a house where they heard a boy had been born 2 years ago at almost exactly the right time. They were very interested.
One of the monks got the impression that the boy recognized him. Excited that this meant the boy was the reincarnated Dalai Lama, the monks left and came back with a large contingent.
And so they put a variety of objects out in front of the boy, some of which had belonged to the Dalai Lama and some of which were just ordinary copies that hadn't. Rosaries and walking sticks and prayer drums and the likes. So first the boy picked up the right rosaries and put them round his neck. And then he reached out towards the wrong stick and was about to pick it up, then changed his mind and picked up the Dalai Lama stick. And all the monks celebrated and cried and believed they'd found the 14th Dalai Lama.
Stephen says this narrative doesn't quite solve the mortality paradox.
Of course, it's easy for most humans to imagine this soul-like thing resides somewhere within them. But actually, from a philosophical point of view, it's very hard to say what a soul is, where it is, what makes mine different from yours, what it's made from, and so forth. But now, today, we have additional reasons to be skeptical. And this is because, you know, for many thousands of years, people have used the idea of the soul to explain the fact that we are thinking, conscious beings. You know, it seems mysterious that we humans have intellect and memory and so forth. We don't think rocks or plants have those things. Well, what is it that enables us to have these powers? Well, it's because we have a soul. At least so the story has been for a long time. But now, of course, we understand the brain much better than people previously. We do know that our mental faculties, like memory and beliefs, even things like a sense of right and wrong, our capacity for emotion, all of these different faculties actually correlate to bits of the brain. My own father died of a brain tumor, and I could see the ways in which, as the tumor ate up his brain, it was changing his personality. Well, this is a very profound problem for those who think that the real me, the real you, actually is our souls. I mean, if my father had a soul that was the real him, that could preserve his personality and memories and beliefs, etc., on into the afterlife, why couldn't it do that just when part of his brain was being damaged by a brain tumor?
So we've looked at three of your immortality narratives, the idea of rejuvenation, the idea of resurrection, and the idea of reincarnation. And this brings us to our last strategy. You introduced the idea in the book by describing some of the exploits of Alexander the Great. Recount some of that history to me, if you remember it, and tell me what it says about the final immortality narrative.
So Alexander the Great was, of course, one of the great Greek heroes. He grew up reading about the exploits of Achilles and the other great Greek heroes. And he wanted to become one of them. He wanted to become part of the pantheon. And if we remember the story of Achilles, you know, the great Greek warrior who fought at Troy, when Achilles himself was on the beach at Troy, he faced a choice. He knew, because it had been prophesied by his mum, who was a goddess, that he could stay and fight at Troy, and if he did, he'd become a legend, known as the greatest warrior of all time, and his story would be told forever. Or he could just go home and be king of a minor kingdom and have children and go hunting and live a long and happy life. And of course, he chose to stay and fight and die. And here we are talking about him many thousands of years later. Now, Alexander the Great knew this story inside out. And he even claimed some kind of lineage from Achilles, from his mother's side, and a few other gods as well. And he set out to beat Achilles himself to become an even greater legend. And so all of Alexander's exploits, and we see him as a great conquering hero, of course, because he brought Greek civilization to much of Asia. But of course, he killed hundreds of thousands of people. This was a man whose exploits were legendary, but also terrible, incredibly destructive, and they were driven by this one impulse to attain a greater fame than even Achilles.
You know, eternity is a long time, and it's not clear that even those who seek fame with the determination that Alexander sought fame really can hold on to that fame for any length of time. I mean, it seems like the search for fame is itself a puny way to overcome death.
I think it's very natural for us to think that our civilizations, which completely shape our lived reality, are somehow forever. And so if we can attain some kind of fame in this society now, then it will be a kind of forever. But of course, history teaches us something very different. And maybe all of these millions of photos that we're taking of ourselves and spreading around the internet in just a couple of generations we'll find are on files that are now unreadable.
There are two underlying problems with all the immortality narratives. First, even though we seek immortality, most of us wouldn't know what to do with it if we had it. As the novelist Susan Ertz writes, millions long for immortality who don't know what to do with themselves on a rainy Sunday afternoon.
Because, of course, it's not eternity that we're seeking. What we want is just to not die. I don't want to die today. I don't think I want to die tomorrow. But, of course, if you never die today or tomorrow, then you end up living forever, even if that wasn't really what you wanted. And when we try to imagine forever, the mind boggles. The mind just gives up and runs. We have no way of grasping something like eternity. And those who have speculated about it and really tried to think it through tend to come to the conclusion pretty quickly that it's going to be boring and miserable.
Stephen says there is a second mistake in all the immortality narratives. They see death as a problem to be solved.
They take the mortality paradox at face value, if you like. They say death is terrifying on the one hand, and it's impossible to imagine not being on the other. And so we have to try to reconcile these by not dying and keeping going indefinitely. But actually, we can really instead question the assumptions behind the mortality paradox. Because even though it's hard to imagine not existing, that doesn't mean we won't cease to exist. Now, this is a difficult thought to grapple with, and I think the first person who really did grapple with it, at least in recorded history, was the Greek philosopher Epicurus, who said, "When I am here, death is not, and when death is here, I am not, and therefore I don't have to worry about dying." So he meant that exactly because death is ceasing to exist, we don't need to think about what might come after. We don't need to think about heaven or hell or keeping it going indefinitely. We won't be around to regret not being around. Now, because of the mortality paradox, because we cannot imagine ceasing to exist, it's very, very hard to accept this. And of course, Epicurus believed you had to kind of repeat it to yourself and as a mantra to truly live according to this insight and so be free of the fear of death.
For Philosopher Stephen Cave works at the University of Cambridge. He's the author of the book Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization. Stephen, thank you for joining me today on Hidden Brain.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
This week's show was produced by Laura Correll and edited by Tara Boyle and Jenny Schmidt. Our team includes Parth Shah, Raina Cohen, and Thomas Liu. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and this is NPR.
Support for Hidden Brain comes from the George and Faye Young Foundation. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Home Advisor, committed to helping homeowners find the right pro for their home projects. Homeowners can get matched to local pros, read reviews, and check project cost guides at homeadvisor.com. And from LD Entertainment and Roadside Attractions, presenting Judy, starring Renee Zellweger as Judy Garland, as she arrives in London for a run of sold-out shows 30 years after she starred in The Wizard of Oz, now playing in theaters.